Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now is The Economist magazine's Middle East affairs correspondent, Nicholas Pelham. We'll talk about some of the news from the area this week, including the first bus bombing in Israel in 10 years yesterday. It injured 21 people. The 7 months of increased Israeli-Palestinian violence that preceded it, though it's not making the news in this country very much. President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia, as President Obama is going there while threatening to veto a bill in Congress that would allow 9/11 victims' families to sue the Saudi government if they find evidence of complicity in the September 11, 2001 attacks. Amazing to think it's been 15 years this year. We'll talk about these new developments, but Nicholas Pelham's book is about an underlying big idea, reviving pluralism in the Middle East. It is simply called Holy Lands, Reviving Pluralism in the Middle East. The Economist's Middle East affairs correspondent, Nicholas Pelham, joins us now. Hello and welcome to WNYC.
Hello, Brian, and thank you for inviting me on what is a pretty special day for New York.
You have a term you use in the book that will be new to most listeners, so let's do the vocabulary word first, and the word is militism. What's a millet besides a grain we don't eat very much, and what is militism?
The millet was the system which the Ottoman Empire, which ruled the Middle East for something like over half a millennium, it was a system which they used to maintain that rule, and what it was a way of dividing up an incredibly diverse region by sect and delegating authority to the religious leaders of that sect. And it proved a remarkably stable system of government, a remarkably inclusive system of government. Religions and sects shared the same public space. They had no real control over territory. They had control over their congregations, and it gave them an enormous breadth and created religions which were universal in outlook rather than the sort of chauvinistic land cults that we see across the region today.
In fact, you argue that in the 19th century, the Middle East under the Ottoman Empire was more pluralistically tolerant than Europe at that time. Can you flesh that out, that comparison, a little bit?
The reason why you have so many sects in the Middle East today is because they have survived and they've been preserved and protected by Islam for 1,400 years, right up until the modern era. If you compare that with Europe, indigenous religions were pretty much wiped out. They don't exist today. There is kind of one dominant faith. That hasn't historically been the case in the Middle East. So the good news is that religion has worked as a building block of society in the past, and it's kept religions and multiple sects together, and that's actually a base on which you can build today.
Though I guess an alternative view of that would be that Europe has encouraged this assimilation into Frenchness or Germanness or whatever it is, and that has been working better in this century than post-Ottoman Empire, maybe because they encouraged the identification with all those factions, that they were setting the seeds for this sectarianism that has blown up the region in recent years.
I think that's absolutely right, that in the West we like to think of religion as being very harmful to any mixture of religion and state as being harmful to stability in societies. And we look at all these religious groups in the region and we think, if only they were more secular and more like us, wouldn't it be a happier place? And actually, if you look at the record that the West has tried to empower secular leaderships across the region, but all that has done is to enhance a sectarian divide along territorial lines. It's done a pretty poor job over the past century of trying to keep the peace. And I think what I'm trying to do in Holy Lands is to look back at the past, look at what worked, and ask the question, can religious leaders play a much larger role in keeping the peace just as they did in the past?
So just to fill in another building block of the history, you were just suggesting that the Ottoman Empire fell about a century ago and Europe colonized and carved up much of the Middle East in different ways and ended that system of militism.
Yeah, there was this top-down process of colonial rulers dividing up the territory by sect, sorry, dividing up the Ottoman Empire by sect, but trying to parcel each of the sects into a homeland. So you have the Balfour Declaration, you have attempts in Syria to create Alawite enclaves, Druze enclaves, Sunni enclaves. You have an attempt to establish Lebanon as a Maronite state. And actually, that attempt, which dates back a century, we're still in the process of perpetuating that with, when we talk about federalism for Iraq or federalism for Syria, we're looking at how you can separate sects. And I think on territorial lines, what I'm trying to argue in Holy Lands is that historically, sects have found a much better way of coexisting and living together when they share the same public space, not when they're divided.
Can you put the genie back in the bottle?
That's obviously kind of the essential question. And it's, I think all you can do is to look at who are the religious leaders in the region who still espouse some of the ideas of the Ottoman Empire. In fact, what I was doing in Holy Lands was to go to religious centers like Najaf, which is the Shia center of Iraq, and to meet rabbis and to meet with leaders of what we consider to be hardline jihadi movements, and to ask them what region do they aspire to. And actually, this Ottoman idea of sects sharing the same public space is still very much alive in the region. We're just not hearing these voices. And so Holy Lands is trying to give space to Ayatollahs in Najaf, or to rabbis who are working with Hamas leaders, to look at how the region could be organized in such a way where religions can live together.
My guest is Nicholas Pelham, The Economist's Middle East Affairs correspondent. His new book is called Holy Lands, Reviving Pluralism in the Middle East. I wonder if anybody with ties to the Middle East from any sect of Islam or Judaism or Christianity or anything else might have a question about this or a reaction to this idea. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I don't know your whole plan, but I imagine that among those who might feel most threatened by your emphasis on pluralism could be Jewish Israelis. Because the whole point of Israel is to have one safe space in the world after 2,000 years of exile and persecution, climaxing with the Holocaust, to have a little country of their own, which is not to say Israel hasn't done some really bad things. But they don't see being a minority group in a pluralistic Middle East like being a minority group in a pluralistic United States, let's say, despite some okay times under the Ottomans, as the path to anything good in the long run.
Possibly. I mean, if you look at kind of where are the main Ottoman historians around the world today, they're, of course, in the Turkish Republic. The second largest concentration of Ottoman scholars happens to be in Israel. There are many scholars in Israel who are looking back at a time and asking, how was it that religions and sects coexisted for centuries? How did they keep the peace in the past? And why is it failing to happen in the present? But yes, you're absolutely right. The notion of a nation state for Jews is core to Zionism. I think what I tried to do in this book is to take a step back and look at, you know, each sect likes to think of themselves as unique, but in that process of turning a religious community into a holy land, a holy community into a holy land, you pretty much see a very similar pattern emerge across all the various sects. There's a process of myth building, a recollection of past times of glory, a period of intense suffering. That's essential to the myth building. There's then a re-landscaping of territory to emphasize the dominance of one sect and minimize those of others. Often it's accompanied by population displacement. There's often an application of religious law, even in secular societies, to segregate one sect from another. And I think what is unique about this process, in that sense, I don't actually see Israel as an exception in the region. I see it very much part and parcel of this process of turning sects into states and communities which have lived together, have shared the same villages, towns, cities, are now living very separate lives. And I think that's very much a modern phenomena. And I'm not sure that... it's a process which is going to continue forever. We can talk about why there are actually kind of communities are coming back together, sharing the same public space, but have yet to find a formula for how that can work.
So Israel as a Jewish state, in the sense they mean it over there, could exist and still operate with the kind of pluralism that you're holding up as a model?
I think that Israel in its secular form in some ways is very similar to the establishment of Greece or the conversion of the Ottoman Empire into the Turkish Republic, perhaps even to the creation of a Shiistan that some people talk about in southern Iraq, Sunnistan or Jihadistan. They're all an attempt to separate along sectarian lines. And yes, there needs to be a process where the region looks back at how can they again turn back holy lands into religious communities.
Let's take a call. Jake in Midtown Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Nicholas Pelham, the Economist Middle East correspondent. Hi. Jake, you there? No, Jake. Let's try Joe in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Joe. Yeah.
Good morning. I find problematical some of your guests' historical assertions. The millet system, which governed inter-religious relations between the different groups in the Ottoman Empire up to the mid to late 19th century, was premised upon an overall Muslim or Islamic supremacy. Just to give you a couple examples, in this particular aspect, continues in the present-day Middle East and almost every and Near East, almost every country. It was impermissible for anyone to convert from Islam to Christianity, whereas the converse was very much encouraged. There were great restrictions on building of churches, and of course, for a couple of centuries until the 17th century, there was the horrendous system of inscription or kidnapping, if you will, of Christian boys to serve in the Ottoman Janissary Corps. And in that respect, your guest has a rather romanticized and somewhat ahistorical view of what was occurring under the Ottoman Empire.
All right, let me get a response. Nicholas?
I think there's a danger about projecting the division we see in society today back into the past. If one of the things I do in the book is I went with the scion of one of the Ottoman caliphs, Abdulhamid, to a hospice which he built above the Golden Horn in Istanbul. It's a beautiful hospice. There's a mosque at one end of the hospice, and there's a synagogue and a church at the other. This was a caliph who happened to be considered to be very Islamist in his outlook. It was at a time of the Ottoman Empire where Christian communities in southeastern Europe were sloughing off the yoke of the Ottoman Empire. There was concern that the Armenians might be joining the Russians, and he was building churches. And if you compare that to the record of secular leaders in Turkey today, it's taken them 90 years of the Turkish Republic to license the first construction of a church. Historically, the record of religious leaders has been much more tolerant than that of than that of secular leaders. Let me just give you one last example. When I was living in Jerusalem, I was living across from Jaffa Gate. It was only after several years that somebody actually took me to Jaffa Gate. We looked inside, and there was an Ottoman inscription on the walls, which gave a new rendition of the Islamic Testament of Faith. It said, "There is no God but God, and Abraham is the prophet of God, is the friend of God." And that is a way of trying to include all communities in a single public space. I don't think we're seeing that as a model at all in much of the Middle East today.
Joe, thank you for your call. Here's another caller who wants to push back on your interpretation of history. Is it Trudy in Nassau County?
Yes.
Trudy, hi.
Thank you. Your guest should check his facts about the Ottoman Empire and the coexistence of different religions in public spaces. And I have a personal story to share. I know for a fact that Christians in Beirut, Lebanon, were second-class citizens. My great-grandfather was jailed in Constantinople because he walked on the wrong side of the street. And my family had to lose property to get him back with gold and a big price tag. And they burnt his throat just because he had the courage to speak back.
Trudy, thank you very much. A disturbing story, and I'm sorry that happened to your great-grandfather. So it sounds like we're hearing from some Jews and Christians whose sense of it is, well, at very least this was based on Islamic supremacy, and maybe it wasn't all it's cracked up to be.
I mean, there are undoubtedly cases of abuse. She's right that there were times and places where you had a breakdown of the system where Muslims might taunt Christians by saying "Shimmel, shimmel, move on to the left." This, I think, much of these incidents happened at a time where nationalism and sectarian nationalism was eroding the fabric of the Ottoman Empire. It was system was eroding over a sort of 100 years prior to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, with the influx of European nationalism, with the rise of, in some sense, sort of Christian supremacy. If you look at what was happening in Eastern Europe, and we don't talk about it, you know, much of that was there were mosques, there were Muslims who were living there, who were pushed out by these Christian nationalist movements to create modern states of Southeastern Europe. There was a breakdown of this fabric with the influx of nationalism, with the support of colonial powers for minorities across the Middle East, and with this transition of religious communities into religious states.
Nicholas Pelham, my guest, the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. His new book is called Holy Lands, Reviving Pluralism in the Middle East. And before you go, let's talk about the news a little bit. There was a bus bombing in Jerusalem yesterday, 21 people injured, they say. Bus bombings haven't been an issue for a decade or so, and it's not even entirely clear that this is an act of terrorism as opposed to something else, according to the police, though Hamas has praised it. What do you make of it?
It's certainly a very worrying development. We've been now sort of pretty much without any political horizon in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for 6 years. There's been some sort of lip service paid. There have been some American efforts. But if you're in the region today, it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish or whether you're Palestinian, you don't feel that there's any prospect for any resolution of this conflict. The views seem to become more and more cemented and the communities are more and more polarized. The abilities for access and movement are extremely limited. And you know, it's tensions are building and building and building without any way of diffusing them.
And it's actually beneath the headlines usually in this country, but Israeli-Palestinian violence has ebbed up again in the last half year or so, with different kinds of attacks than in the past. Stabbings, some shootings, even people running each other down with cars.
I think all these are manifestations of just the extreme frustration, the inability for the political leaders in Israel, in Palestine, to offer their populations any way forward, any political horizon, any way out of military occupation. You know, most Palestinians will have known nothing but military domination of their society by another.
Next year marks 50 years.
Absolutely, you know, and the average age is probably about half that for Palestinians. And so, you know, and there's where is the exit strategy? What is the end game? Until you can reinject some form of hope for the population, I think the violence is going to increase.
And does the U.S. have any role to play, a different role to play, if we have a president who puts Palestinian needs more near the center along with Israeli needs, as Bernie Sanders has been running on? If you have a president who is an expert at the art of the deal, I don't think I have to name the name, would there be any more hope, or does none of this matter?
I mean, I think, of course it matters. But I think first and foremost, you have to have political leaders in the region who are going to offer some hope. If they're not willing to engage, you've either got to have an American government which is determined to impose its terms, or you've got to be faced with or you're going to continue this steady build-up of tension. This conflict is not going away. It doesn't
impose its terms. The U.S. could impose its terms.
I think that is something which I don't think is going to happen because of politics inside the U.S. It's up to the leaders of them in the region to realize that there was a model in the past that worked. Religions can live together. Religious movements, which are, still play a very powerful role in the region, should be brought into the political process. Access and movement, as long as that's curtailed, you're going to have a greater polarization.
What could get the Netanyahus on the one side, the Hamases on the other side, to that position? Is it only that things will get so bad for the people on each side?
There are kind of moments of hope in Holy Lands, and I found one of the most hopeful was
in
when
your
I,
book, Holy
in,
Lands.
In the book, and I found one of the most hopeful was when I met rabbis who were working with Hamas leaders to try and find a way forward to when the place of worship of one community is attacked, the other community will condemn it. Will condemn those who are the perpetrators. That. Below the surface, religious leaders are trying to find a way forward. I find that some of their ideas were remarkably forward-thinking. If there's a way of trying to listen to religious leaders, religious movements, to bring them into the process, rather than assume that secular leaders are going to be the solution when they failed so miserably over the past century, I think that actually there could be a better future for the Middle East.
And last thing, President Obama going to Saudi Arabia this week at a very difficult moment there, including low oil prices, Obama himself saying recently that the Saudis are free riders, intense competition with Iran for regional dominance, and more. What's the goal of the president's trip?
I think everybody is asking that same question. Is he saying, is this a farewell trip? Is he trying to mend fences? Is he trying to tell the Saudis that America hasn't abandoned the Sunni world, as kind of Saudi leaders feel?
The U.S. feels that Sunni leaders have abandoned us, right? I mean, all the presidential candidates say, and on both sides, say Sunni countries like Saudi Arabia need to get on the battlefield to help ISIS, which is Sunni, but it's not
to
happening.
To confront ISIS.
To help help with the fight against ISIS. Is that part of the reason for the trip?
Across the region is more and more polarized by sect. I think that if Obama is going to have any hope of getting that message across, he's got to listen as well as Hector. I think there.
How do the Sunnis feel that we're letting them down?
They look back over the past 10 years. They see the invasion of Iraq as the toppling of a Sunni leader there and opening the gates to Iran, and they see that process continuing under Obama with the engagement with Iran. They look at the successive wars that have taken place against Sunni communities. They see Sunnis being disempowered across the region. In fact, if you look from a Saudi perspective at what has happened, you see that four Arab capitals, which were in their conception under Sunni leaders, are now predominantly under Shia rule, whether it's in Baghdad or Damascus or in Beirut, and most recently in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, that they see the world slipping away from them. And maybe one sort of last message, that to look at actually look at Saudi society itself, in many ways the dominant religious ideology is the same as in as ISIS. It's a Wahhabi rule, but it's actually, over the past century, it hasn't done anything like what ISIS has done in 2 months. It's preserved religious communities. You've got many Shia communities who are there, who are granted public spaces, still in the hands of Wahhabi ideologues, but religious communities have survived. And maybe to find a way of recognizing that and encouraging Saudi Arabia to promote some of the to promote pluralism in its own backyard.
Well, we see how far the Middle East has gone when Saudi rule can be seen as a model of religious pluralism in any way, but there we are with Nicholas Pelham, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, and the author now of the book Holy Lands, Reviving Pluralism in the Middle East. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.